Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schinkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And through our interviews with people from all facets of manufacturing, supply chain, and operational management, we want you to get three things from the podcast. Number one is we want you to see whether you can gain some insights and tips into how to accelerate some of the operational initiatives that you're trying to implement to make improvements in your operation. Second, we want you to see the link and improve the link in employee engagement and making improvements to the operation, because they do go hand in hand. We believe that true employee engagement drives value. And third, of course, to help you in your development, whether you aspire to higher levels of future promotion or you just want to get better in the role that you have right now, we want you to be able to develop some strengths in fulfilling your full potential and also achieving best ever results with less stress. Our guest today is Ben Whitney, who is the president of Armo Tool and Abuma Manufacturing in London, Ontario, Canada. Ben is a smart cookie. He has his Master's of Engineering in Design and Manufacturing Engineering from Western University. And his companies, Armo Tool and Abuma Manufacturing, they really focus on creating automation solutions that automate processes. They deliver technology that their customers use to make advanced products at higher volumes and lower costs. My father, Erwin Schinkel, who passed away last year, actually started working with Ben's father, George Whitney, more than 30 years ago. So I was around, because I'm a little bit older, I was around as Ben took over the company. And Ben has really impressed me because he's built an amazing team. He's grown the business through acquisition. He's expanded into new markets, and he's really positioned the company well to take on rapidly evolving global markets. So, Ben Whitney, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate the generous intro and the opportunity to be here.
Hey, well, thank you for being our guest today. You know, Ben, one of the things that for our listeners and viewers, what they want to really know, of course, is both from the successes and the challenges. But let's start off with, what's an example of a project that you were involved in that really turned out well, one of your big wins? Because we believe that confidence really comes from some of those wins, because up till then it's really just enthusiasm. So what's a win that you're proud of in achieving for the business, for yourself?
Sure. Well, our business is a family business, so a lot of the team and the structure and success of the organization I grew up through and inherited. In 2017, we acquired a company called Abuma Manufacturing. And by then I was the president and I was leading that project. And when I went to Abuma, it was a team of about 30 people, and they'd been struggling with sales, and they had a lot of long-term people who really knew what they were doing, but the organization hadn't been succeeding. The owner was in his early 70s and looking to retire. So I knew when I got there, it was going to be important to get enthusiasm and, you know, buy-in from the team that we were going to do things a little bit differently. And, you know, I remember the first day there, I was really excited, and I took a desk sort of in the middle of the open office so that I could hear what was happening and start to understand the culture and how things got done. And people told me months later, you know, you worked through lunch that first day and everybody's like, oh my God, this guy is going to be impossible as a boss. Like, look, he worked through lunch. Well, he's going to be a slave driver, right? And I remember I was still there when everybody else left for the day. But one of the things that I did that worked really well is I did a survey for every employee, and it was just a simple two-page. And what it said was, you know, what's two or three small ideas for improvement and one or two big ideas for improvement. And I gave a couple of examples of what those might be. And I told people that they could, that this could be anonymous, but I was really impressed. The vast majority of people returned it with their names on it. And then we created a list of all of their suggestions. And then we really worked on knocking a bunch of those off. And the great thing was that it gave us a mandate to do a lot of things that we already had on our list, but now it was the team's ideas. And because there was some anonymous ones, we could also sneak one or two ideas onto the list that really came from myself and the new management team.
Awesome. You
And
know,
I was
go
really
ahead.
proud that we had almost no turnover. We only had one person leave the company in the first year, and they turned out to be one of the people with the least amount of seniority, actually.
Wow. By the way, I want to call out a few things because people can just kind of hear the story and not. There's a few things you did there, which I think are good lessons for anyone who takes over a new operation. So, first off, you just went in and you observed for a while. At the same time, you demonstrated some leadership by example by being there early and staying late. You asked for involvement, even though some of those involvement ideas you may have been able to observe on your own, but they came from the team. So even if you had the same idea, you can always, of course, give them credit and involve them. And usually they do come up with some things that you weren't really thinking or didn't have an idea of the magnitude of it. So, I guess, so here's the good news, everybody. You learn from your successes and you can learn from your disappointments as well. I'm wondering, Ben, what's an example where things got maybe tougher? Maybe at the time didn't turn out as well as that you'd hoped, but you know, in the fullness of time, maybe you still gained something even from the things that didn't go well.
Yeah, we certainly had lots of challenges along the way and had. Yeah, so we've certainly had challenges along the way and lots of things haven't worked out. When I joined the business, I was in my early 20s, and one of the managers, he had a ton of enthusiasm, but he really managed from a position of anger. Was really hard on people, really hard on his whole team. I mean, I remember him calling me when I was sort of a junior manager on his team and saying, this is wrong again. Come to my office, wear a helmet, and hung up his phone so hard that I could hear it physically travel through the plant from where I was sitting a couple hundred feet and one story away. And as a young person, I was kind of impressed by his passion, and he was extremely capable, and he get things done. But I remember it wasn't really my style, and I was kind of uncomfortable with it. But I took a course where they talked about how when you're angry, of course your blood pressure goes up, and they can do cognitive tests and sort of show for every point your blood pressure goes up, basically your IQ goes down 2 points.
I love
And I'm not
that.
interested in being dumber, right? So I really took away from that, being angry basically never has value, right? And it's you can have passion and be excited, and certainly I am that way, but I just really over time learn not to get angry about challenges or situations.
All right, good stuff. Yeah, so that was a lesson that you saw from how other people did and the emotional content of that. I think that's awesome. I know well, maybe we didn't ask you some just basic questions, although people can certainly look up ARMO and ABUMA online. But give us an idea of maybe scope of either headcount and maybe the not necessarily the specifics of the projects, but kind of the scope of some of the work that you do, just so the people have a better understanding of the size of the business and where you're operating.
Sure. Today we have two locations, both in the same city, London, Ontario, and we have a headcount of 200 people. We're a job shop, so we're constantly thinking about sales. We've got to sell our capacity every day. And we have almost all skilled labor. So it's really fun to work with smart, engaged people. And we have interesting work. We have a good work environment where it is air conditioned throughout the plants and well lit. So yeah, it's a fun, exciting place to work.
And you deliver projects where? With your machines, your tools, your automation?
We're exporting nearly half of what we're doing, and our Mexico and the US go back and forth as being our biggest export market. And just this morning, we were starting to arrange a service install call where we'll have to go to South Korea. So we do
Oh,
a bit of
wow.
global work too.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, if we kind of transition because we're looking at operational leadership and operational improvements, and I know that you're familiar with the various toolkits and tool sets and initiatives, some of which are fads, some are standing the test of time. But again, because you do a lot of job shop work, you're not really running long production runs. I wondered what your either take or insights are in terms of applying operational improvements to your various processes, knowing that every project has some unique elements to it.
The idea that projects are different, try and drill past that to that being an illusion. Every project has a kickoff, every project has a customer scope, every piece of steel that we're machining has holes in it, so therefore get better at drilling holes. Every block of steel has to be measured, get better at measuring. Communicating, scheduling. Try not to let people tell you this project's different.
So even though the machine itself may be different from the previous one, they're still going through similar processes, and those processes can still be optimized and improved. Is that right? Okay. This one wasn't necessarily on the sheet, but it's something that I was interested in is you've done a lot of work within the automotive industry, but you also do work in defense. Do a little bit of work, I think, in medical and other sort of adjacent industries. I just wondered, what's your read on how the market is evolving and changing right now from maybe how it was, 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Is there some trends that affect companies like yours who are providing services to a number of different OEMs and maybe some suppliers to OEMs?
Yeah, there's a few trends for sure. One is around people are hard to get and skilled people are even harder to get. So people are willing to take maybe a little longer payback period just to have less operators. I think there's a focus on quality and quality control and retaining data. So lots more parts are barcoded, lots more pictures of a part or test results or manufacturing process details tied to that part and then put to a cloud somewhere. And then a focus on flexibility because there seems to be, volumes are getting smaller and so really want a machine that'll make five different variants of a part instead of make one variant really, really fast. So all of those fads.
So
Trends.
with the move to, well, the automotive industry is a good example where, the number of models and manufacturers really has proliferated, and there's still some volume leaders, but there's also probably a greater volume or model mix, although that changed a little bit during COVID times. I didn't know, is that changing things too, because the run sizes are changing or the need to change over is more frequent?
People want flexible fixturing, flexible robotics. They want to do an engineering change on an existing robotic weld cell rather than building a whole new one. Very much lower volume, higher mix. And it's true that like car XYZ might have had five trim levels and it's gone down to three, but the volume of that overall model is still shrinking. And most of the parts we're involved with are metal parts, and they tend not to be different between those trim levels so much. So yeah, we're seeing lower volume. And then robots and vision systems are getting better so fast that there really is, you can build in more flexibility into a cell.
It's one of the things, and you know this, that I admire that you have to grapple with, but I'm also, as a business owner, conscious of the need for constant reinvestment because, the tools get faster, the machines get faster, the vision systems are getting better. Can you speak to that in terms of how to compete in your industry to still be, I guess, the vendor of choice or supplier of choice for some of your customers related to what you have to do to improve the business?
Well, we're fortunate in that we're quite vertically integrated. I think if you were relying, whatever you don't understand within your organization, if you're relying on a supplier and you don't ask the supplier, am I doing this in the best way? Then they have a tendency to just sell you what you ask for. And maybe you don't appreciate that what you're asking for is quickly becoming not best in class, right? Obsolete.
So then sorry, then you're explaining that so that the customer understands there's a different level of innovation they could be embracing?
Right. So
Or you're
one of
just saying
our
that if you don't know about it, you can't bring the value from it in the project or to the customer, and you're kind of just relying on that other person in the supply chain or that other company in the supply chain who doesn't realize that what they're offering kind of isn't best in class. Is that what you were meaning?
Yeah, we've got a smaller competitor and they're building a machine similar to ours if you went back in time 15 years, but the cameras that are being used and the control systems that are being used, our machine has moved quite a long ways. And that's because they just don't have much controls expertise in-house and they're building what they're comfortable with. And maybe it's even still what their customer's asking for, but their machine's looking older and older next to ours, even when it's brand new.
Right. So it's just you need to be on the cutting edge, and because the innovation and technology is improving so much, you have to always be looking at that. And I know that you do that. I want to go towards our organization for a minute. And I
Okay.
know, like you spoke about the one manager who, gave you one of those lessons in how not to lead.
Yeah.
And I know over the years you've evolved your organization quite a bit, partly just to achieve growth, partly just to adapt. Partly just because, it has been so many decades of you running the business that some of those folks would have retired. But I'm interested because to deliver what you deliver to your customer requires like this orchestration across all these different departments and functions. How do you manage the interrelationship between those departments? Because they often have sort of their own either goals or mandates or what they think success looks like. And it could be at odds maybe with what another department's goals or mandates or success looks like. And I just wondered, how have you created the culture and the atmosphere that I guess mostly deals with that? You're never going to completely eliminate it, but do you have some thoughts on departments and how they align in terms of what they prioritize?
Yeah, silos are tough. One thing is that our manufacturing group serves the sort of customer facing product groups, and I don't make them into a profit center, even though maybe lots of people would say that you should. And I do that because I want them to serve the other groups. So if I'm in the automation group and I'm trying to sell a piece of automation and oh, we forgot something and I need this block done in a big hot hurry and I go to manufacturing, if manufacturing's a profit center, then instead of saying I'll get that done for you today, they say things like, oh, I'm going to charge you extra and I'm going to just get this done for me because I know the big picture that this block is really important and that's what's going to drive it. And to the point that if somebody is asking manufacturing for, well, why don't you guys just do this job for me? You used to work with me and I'm a customer. No, we hand that off to tooling and let them provide project management and then they schedule and organize. I think if you're serving customer facing groups, you can't also be a customer facing group. You
Oh,
start to get
interesting.
a
Yeah.
uh
That's good because I do think that that's actually a challenge that we're trying to solve through a new model that we created called the Operational Priorities Accelerator model. And what it
Hmm.
says is that over time, usually not by design, it just kind of evolves that way, that the departments have their own sort of metrics and goals and measurements, and they start to put a lot of emphasis on those, but no one is necessarily sort of doing the air traffic control between them to say, really, like let's focus on what we actually have to deliver to the customer and make sure we're aligned all on that, even if it might
Yeah.
disadvantage us. And I think what you're saying is manufacturing might say, hey, it's going to work out better for us from our cost and efficiencies to do it in this order or to move from this job to this job, not necessarily to put your job faster, but meanwhile, the customer has a tight deadline on something or it's going to hold up other operations. And so you need to make the sacrifice in manufacturing, even though your efficiencies might look bad as you change over another machine or, disrupt a run mid-run or something like that.
Yeah, because when manufacturing starts to think about their own efficiency too much, they start to say things like, let's outsource all the most difficult manufactured blocks. Well, actually, we're capable and somewhat expensive manufacturing site. We want to actually keep the most challenging blocks. And those are the blocks where it's most likely something will go wrong or it needs a lot of informal communication. Well, that happens best within our own walls. So you see how a simple metric like machine uptime drives you towards something that's not really in the best interest of the organization.
So if I go even further, so from just the organization of the functions to the people, I know that we've benefited because you've continued to send your frontline leaders to our frontline leadership program, and I appreciate that. I also know, having known you for so long, that you, even though you're technically minded, you also have this sense of culture and behaviors and leadership, and I know you've had your shares of having to deal with, getting leaders aligned to the right way of doing things and the right way of handling situations. But I wondered, what we're noticing is that most of the time when we go into doing leadership development, everyone's kind of happy as long as everyone gets something, first of all, thinks that the training is decent, and I know we get good feedback from your people. But it's like, what's your view of, I don't know, leadership, culture, how people get treated. Do you have any insights you can share on that?
So I used to say that so my dad was really good at empowering his managers and really making them feel like entrepreneurs who are running their own business. And that was really good for getting them to take ownership. And then I wanted to centralize and standardize things a little bit. So I had some trouble with the management team that I inherited, because I was asking them for some different things. And I kind of said, it's like driving a chariot. And, my managers are the four horses that are pulling the chariot. It's my job to keep them pulling in the same direction. But if they bite each other every once in a while, that's okay because they're, high-strung stallions and they're gonna, so some amount of bumping and friction between them is okay as long as things are traveling in the same direction.
Okay. All right.
But I'm
So,
not sure I would agree with that when it comes down to frontline supervisors. I don't want that level of individualism and conflict,
Right.
And now we have them much less, biting and nipping between them than we used to.
I want to go a little different. So one of the aspects that I've talked to senior leaders about, and I know I ran through this with you in a meeting that we had a few months ago, it's this idea. Well, we've called it decision-making waste, but that's probably the negative view of it. You could view it instead like
Okay.
empowerment. But it's like, to the extent that senior people get involved with issues that probably should have been dealt with a layer below, or maybe two layers below, and the distraction that causes, plus of course the person who should have been making the call, who didn't make the call, or maybe was afraid to make the call, kicks it up a level instead of taking care of it, which kind of hurts their own level of motivation and ownership. And that's a very broad preamble and ramble. But what do you think in terms of this idea of having people understand the kinds of things that they should generally be focused on, knowing that, even in your position, you'll do a deep dive every once in a while if something goes enough sideways, but that you don't want to spend your time down there doing the work that other people should be taking care of. So, do you have some thoughts on, I mean, you've probably seen people do that really well, and you've seen people do it poorly, and you've probably struggled with it yourself. So, any insights on that?
Well, I love solving problems, but that's not actually a great leadership trait, I think. when we promote somebody to supervisor, my advice is when somebody brings you a problem, right? What do you think we should do? That sounds good. Those are the only two sentences you need. And because otherwise you can get tricked quickly into where you're making all the decisions for your team.
And what you're saying is what happens when you do that is the person will usually go ahead and do what you wanted them to do, but their sense of ownership has dropped way off. Versus what you're saying is if I ask, what do you think you should do? And as long as it's not like a lose the company kind of consequence from it, by all means, like, all right, go for it. Because even when you know that it might not be the way you would have done it, eventually they might come to that conclusion, which is way more powerful than if they just tried to execute what you said, right? Okay.
Yeah, and people get addicted to being told what to do. And of course, add other questions. Like if you don't really like their suggestion, right? Then you just add more questions is really, in my mind, the best practice of like, huh, well, isn't there something we could do sooner? Do we need to wait for that person to come in? Oh, last time, didn't we do something different than that? And try and get them,
Asking the questions
thinking.
for, get them asking the questions. I like it, but I see what you mean. It's frustrating sometimes because you know that maybe the most direct route from A to B is just to tell them what it is and just learning that you don't really gain in the long run by not it, the development of their wisdom over time is so valuable that it's better just to guide and ask questions and then I guess, count on the fact that they're smart people. They're gonna learn from the things that worked well and not well, and maybe just make observations.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be the conductor and stand in front of the orchestra and tell every single person what to do all the time, and they all have sheet music that tells them the operating instructions, but most manufacturers are not like that.
It's funny because you say that. I remember the story of this one automotive supplier, and they were doing they were actually they were making metal parts, but the quality manager said if it's not on the SOP, you don't have to do it. If it's not on the work instruction, you don't have to do it. And all chaos, and you can imagine the chaos that broke loose because even though I think what he wanted to do is to say let's follow this standardized process, but there's no SOP written that. Literally describes every single thing that you would do in every si single situation. So everything
Yeah.
ground to a halt, and of course he had to retract his statement because people said, "Fine, it's not on, I'm just asking the question," and he got buried in hundreds of questions. With the change, I mean, you've described this in the labor market, saying that not only for you but also for your customers, skilled labor is A, it's more expensive, it's harder to come by. You need to hold on to the people you have and hopefully have them grow in their capabilities. But what's your take on engagement generally with the idea of the multi-generational workforce? It's a reality. You're hiring younger people, people who've come out of maybe different learning programs than tool and die makers would have years ago. I just wondered what your take is on sort of the next generation and how you're trying to make the best of it.
We have young people, more young people, and we also have a lot more newcomers to Canada. So you've got some different cultural ideas there too. I think it starts with communication and engagement, and maybe younger people are they expect to be more involved than maybe older workers did. And mostly that's for the good. I'll go out on the shop floor and have a young guy in his 20s asking me, how did that thing that we finished building, how's the customer liking it? How's it working? And I'm kind of like, oh, your older peer wouldn't necessarily ask that, but it's a great question. I'm really glad that you're happy and thinking about it. And then this young person crack open their notebook and show me, here's my notes from the install. I don't know whether any of this is of interest to you, but so there, I think there's a lot of value there if you take advantage of it. Their time scales are shorter. When you're in your 20s, 2 years is forever. And we did have a young guy quit because we weren't going as fast as he wanted to. And I was coaching his boss, like, when he tells you he wants something, just tell him yes, that is what's happening. But eventually there was enough of a disconnect that he quit and went to one of our competitors, and then within 2 weeks was trying to come back. And we let him stay there about 3 months before we agreed to have him come back to learn it, learn something we felt, but
No, I mean, it's all learning, right? I obviously, the contrite cliche, I suppose, is you're either winning or you're learning, but some lessons are more powerful than others, and that was probably a very good lesson.
When I came to work for my dad, right, I was fresh out of university basically, and he said to me, "How long do you think it'll be till you're ready to be president?" And I was 23, and I remember, university was 4 years. That was clearly forever. So I told him, 7 years, because I couldn't imagine a time span longer than 7 years. And he laughed because he thought it was so short, right? And then 7 years later, I was president.
Well, at least you said seven and you didn't say two or year or move aside,
Well, that would have been a
man.
little much, yeah.
I mean, to knowing the situation a bit at that time, because I'm a few years older than you, so I was taking over for my dad at the time, and I remember, because we were in an advisory group together, is that well, maybe you can tell the story of just how you became president. By the way, to your dad's credit, is he wasn't really eager in holding on any longer than he needed to. He was pretty good
Yeah.
about, like, when he thought you were ready, it was time to go. But can you tell that, relate the story of how you became president?
Well, what I remember is that my dad had a lot of other interests, so he wanted to retire, and he was getting fed up to the point where he was gonna start telling customers what he really thought. And so then he had to go, and basically one summer he took Thursday afternoons and Fridays off, and then by the start of the next summer, he told me that I was president. I'm not sure exactly what you're
Well,
remembering, Greg.
I just remember he did the business cards, I think, with your name on them, and he brought them to that meeting and said, "Okay, you're president," or something. It felt sort of more like not sudden, but maybe somewhat unexpected. But he'd already had it plotted out and had your cards ready. Not that business cards get used much these days.
Yeah, that does ring a bell that he printed cards that said I was president for sure.
I think you raise a good point that you said that your dad was getting to before, he was ready to turn it over to you. And I think, I know from talking to you that you feel this way sometimes, and I know I do, is that your tolerance for some of the aggravations, you really just have to, because you've seen so much and dealt with so much, there's just this sense that maybe I'm not going to put up with as much. You know what? It's been so informative. What I want to ask you is maybe one last question, and it's mostly advice that you would give to someone earlier in your career, because we know people who are listening to the podcast, some of them are going to be more seasoned, looking for tips on how they might accelerate some of the things that they're working on. And other people are going to be maybe newer in their journey in operational leadership, maybe either at the They could be at the supervisor level, they might be at the manager level, wanting to aspire to become a director or a VP someday. And I wondered what piece of advice you might give to someone as they're sort of trying to plot their journey, assuming that they want to grow into a higher level of authority at some point.
I think anytime you're leading people, you have to be careful how far out in front of the troops you get, right? Leading is okay, but they have to be in sight of you. So, I take a course that's about 5S and I get really excited and I go out on the shop floor and say, "Okay, stop working for the day. We're gonna 5S this place." And all everybody else hears is, "We're gonna stop working to clean up. What a waste of time." So you have to do the groundwork to explain to people what 5S is, and be sure you're going to make it stick and get some buy-in, especially with lean. For the frontline worker, lean means cut the fat, which means, uh-oh, am I the fat? And so when you're bringing new initiatives, whether you're a first-time leader, informal leader, or you're the VP, people have to understand where it is you're trying to go, and people have to feel safe.
Yeah, that's a re I really like that tip because we do think that it's so easy to go into shiny object syndrome around tools and techniques, and helping people understand, first of all, why these things are important. And for example, let's say lean, what if it was framed as lean is about removing the frustrations that we find in delivering our work every day, and if we could figure
Yeah,
out how to
we
get
should
rid of
call it
those things.
smooth.
That's right. Well, the biggest thing I wish that people never launched is this concept of lean and mean. Who decided we wanted to be mean? And your
Yeah.
idea of safety is important, not just like physical safety, but psychological safety. Like if I
Yeah.
feel threatened by whatever it is you're putting in front of me, that's just going to cause me to have resistance. So,
Which is
but
basically just trust, right? So I spend a lot of time trying to be personable with people and be authentic and build trust so that when something weird happens, people go, I bet Ben didn't mean for that to happen, not that asshole again.
No, I would agree that what building up trust over time does is it gives you a bit of credit in the emotional bank account, I guess Covey would say, so that you get the benefit of the doubt, or at least that I don't think that that's what that person would do. Hey Ben, I want to respect your time and just say thank you for being on the podcast. If people want to just get to know more about what Armo Tool does or Abuma Manufacturing does, what's the website, the best way that they could find out more about what the companies do?
Sure, they could check us out at armotool.com, or they could get on LinkedIn and search for Armo Tool or for myself, Ben Whitney.
All right, that's awesome. Folks, you really have a gem here in Ben, and I've had the benefit. Most people you meet in your life, you only see a little snapshot of where they are. You don't really know where they came from or the evolution that they've done. Ben has impressed me all the time. He's younger than me. He's super smart, and as a result, what I notice that he does is he just has this way of layering in on his intelligence, because that could be threatening to people at times, but he just lays in that nice, I hope you can get see that Ben lays in that nice relationship side, which we think is important for all leaders to truly excel in whatever position that they have. So thank you, Ben Whitney, for being on the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast. Have a great day, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks, Greg.